Good afternoon and welcome to the 2011 Diane Sanger Memorial Lecture, broadcast live from the Georgetown Law Center and worldwide on www.sechistorical.com. I am Richard Nesson, President-elect of the Securities and Exchange Commission Historical Society, the host for today's program. The SEC Historical Society, which is a nonprofit organization entirely independent of the SEC, shares, preserves, and advances knowledge of the history of financial regulation through our unique virtual museum and archive located at www.sechistorical.org. The museum provides more than 300,000 visitors each year with access to primary resources showing how the U.S. financial regulatory system has been developed. The museum collection allows you to become an eyewitness to history through the words, voices, and images of the people who have built and administer our regulatory system. For at the end of the day, even with the most thoughtful statutes and regulations, it requires the hard work and dedication of the people involved to make our system of financial regulation effective. Today's lecture recognizes one such person, Diane Sanger. In her brief life and career, Diane shared her keen intellect, commitment to justice, and mentoring spirit to the cause of protecting investors and ensuring fairness in the capital markets. Except for a brief period as visiting staff on the Senate Banking Committee, she devoted her entire professional career to the SEC, rising in the General Counsel's office to the rank of Associate General Counsel for Counseling and Regulatory Policy. The SEC recognized Diane's accomplishments in 1994 with a Distinguished Service Award, its highest award, recognizing her outstanding contributions to the work of the Commission and the administration of the federal securities laws. SEC Commissioner Elise Walter, a former colleague, has shared this remembrance of Diane. "I had the pleasure of working with Diane for a number of years. For two of them, she worked for me, or, more accurately, I worked for her. Diane had rigorous standards and was a tough critic. She was insightful, brilliant, and devoted to her work. Perhaps even more important, she had a wicked sense of humor and was the most loyal of friends. I miss her very much." The Diane Sanger Memorial Lecture series recognizes the values that Diane supported throughout her life and helps attain the goals she sought during her career by offering reasoned discourse on the policies and practices needed to promote regulatory reform and fairness of the capital markets. We would like to thank Georgetown University Law Center for joining with us to present today's program. Donald Langevoort, Thomas Aquinas Reynolds, Professor of Law at Georgetown, and a member of the Society's Board of Advisors, will speak on behalf of the school.
Thank you, and I will speak very briefly. It's my privilege and honor to welcome you all here on behalf of Georgetown. Georgetown has a close connection with both the Securities and Exchange Commission and the SEC Historical Society. In fact, if I recall, when the virtual museum was first being thought about, there was a meeting here among a number of academics to give some thoughts and suggestions to what has become a wonderfully successful project. So we are happy to build on our connections with both the Society and the Commission today. It's a particular honor and privilege to welcome the friends and family of Diane Sanger here. I was at the General Counsel's office in 1978 when Diane first came to the Commission, and I had the privilege of working with her. Russ Stevenson, who is on our faculty as a distinguished visitor from practice, came to the Commission and the General Counsel's office shortly after I left and had that same privilege and mentioned to me a while ago what a wonderful thing it was to work with Diane. So I am simply going to turn it back to Richard and let the program go forward. Once again, welcome.
Uh, SEC Historical Society thanks the generosity of the family of Diane Sanger for making possible today's lecture. We welcome her family and friends who joined with us today. Bryna Sanger, Diane's sister, will speak on behalf of the family.
I'm Bryna Sanger. I'm one of Diane's sisters. And on behalf of myself and my family, I'd like to thank Carla Rosati, the executive director of the Historical Society, and Richard Nesson, the president, for sponsoring this lecture, and to Don Langevoort at Georgetown for honoring us with the use of Georgetown and of sponsoring it here, hosting it. You've helped us through this event to provide an appropriate memorial for Diane. For almost 30 years at the SEC, Diane mentored a generation of security lawyers, and in a remarkable career that remained always committed to the importance of ensuring the protection of investors and the fairness of markets. Her life was hard, it was short, but it was principled and purposeful. Regulatory reform and continuous improvement in consumer protection are important ways to achieve the outcomes she sought in her work. And we're just so delighted to have Professor Steve Schwartz with us today to help navigate the impact of the recent efforts to achieve improved performance. This is the second Diane Sanger Memorial Lecture, and we're grateful to have such an eminent legal analyst to help honor Diane's legacy by seeking to advance her most deeply held values. We're grateful to share her memory in this way. Thank you so much.
Over the past few years, of course, we've witnessed profound changes in the capital markets and the financial regulatory process. Responses to the financial crisis of 2008 continue to evolve. One significant response, of course, was the passage of the Dodd-Frank Wall Street Reform and Consumer Protection Act, enacted by Congress last July. Many regulatory agencies, including the SEC, are hard at work now in implementing the provisions of Dodd-Frank. To discuss the creation and impact of Dodd-Frank, we are honored today to hear from Stephen L. Schwartz, Stanley A. Starr Professor of Law and Business at Duke School of Law. Professor Schwartz is a graduate of New York University School of Engineering and Science, where he majored in aeronautics and astronautics and graduated first in his class. He worked on legislative initiatives involving science and law while attending Columbia Law School. Before joining the Duke faculty in 1996, he was a partner at two international law firms where he helped to pioneer the field of asset securitization. His main areas of scholarship today are commercial law, bankruptcy, and international finance and capital markets. He founded and was the first faculty director of Duke's International Global Capital Markets Center. It is my pleasure to welcome Professor Stephen Schwartz.
Thank you, Richard, and thank you, Don, for allowing Georgetown to host this event, and thank you to the Sanger family. I'm honored to be here on behalf of this memorial lecture and in recognition and memory of Diane Sanger. Now, and also thank Carla Rosati for doing a wonderful administrative job. So, setting this up. Securitization has been called into question because of its role in the recent financial crisis. And securitization refers to a category of financing transactions in which companies sell rights to payment under mortgage loans, accounts receivable, lease rentals, any type of financial asset. And they sell these rights to payment to a trust or other special purpose vehicle. Sometimes you hear the term SPV for special purpose vehicle. Similarly, you hear the term SPE for special purpose entity. These are the same. Now, the goal in each case is to separate the financial assets from the risks that are generally associated with a company. And in order to distinguish the special purpose vehicles from the originating company, I call the originating company the originator. Okay. Now, the originator, the idea is it sells the assets to the SPV. The SPV then can issue securities to investors, use the proceeds of the securities to purchase the financial assets. And in doing this, securitization accomplishes a very significant cost savings. First, securitization achieves what's sometimes called disintermediation, removing the intermediary. The intermediary, in most cases, would be a bank. Now, a bank will get its funds in two ways. It will take deposits, but it also issues securities to capital market investors. When it then lends the money, a bank is a business. It wants to make a profit. If you make a profit as an ordinary company, you buy at a low price, sell at a high price. Banks, too, will borrow at a low price and lend at a high price. So in order to eliminate this profit, in effect, of the bank, it would be great if companies can go directly to the capital markets to get their financing. And that's one of the things that securitization does. Think of it like it enables companies to buy not retail but wholesale, okay, which is effectively the same thing. Second, securitization achieves a cost savings because the interest rate payable on securities issued by the SPV is ordinarily lower than if the originator itself had issued securities like bonds or commercial paper. And this interest rate savings reflects that the financial assets sold to the SPV, and it's the SPV that issues the securities, these financial assets are much more trustworthy, more creditworthy than an operating company that engages in a range of business and has creditors and claims against it. Now, investors in the SPV securities expect ultimately to be paid from collections on the financial assets purchased by the SPV. For example, if I'm glad the audience is now doubling a number we have here. So I'll let people sit. So the investors are paid from collections on the financial assets, again, purchased by the SPV. And, for example, let's assume these assets are residential mortgage loans. The investors will ultimately be paid by the mortgage payments made by the homeowners. Securities of an SPV that are payable from or backed by, and you hear asset-backed securities or mortgage-backed securities, that's what it references. These securities, basically, they're called mortgage-backed securities, or MBS, if the financial assets are mortgage loans. They're called asset-backed securities, or ABS, if the financial assets are anything other than mortgage loans. And you might say, aren't mortgage loans assets? This has an historical background, which I'd be happy to answer during the cocktails afterwards. So I will refer in general to ABS, and ABS will include not only mortgage loans, but any type of financial asset-backed security. The first securitization transactions identified as such took place in the 1970s, and these involved pools of mortgage loans. The companies, in many cases savings and loan associations, needed to essentially turn the mortgage loans into cash in order to make new loans. And to achieve this, the government National Mortgage Association, Ginnie Mae, facilitated securitization through the SPVs, then in the form of trusts. And they purchased the mortgage loans and issued securities to investors in the form of trust certificates. Now, since then, securitization has become a principal means, maybe the principal means by which banks, savings and loans, whatever, financial institutions basically will monetize their assets, and this increases home ownership, of course. And it's also become a very important way, at least until recently, and it's hopefully heading on its way back, for companies to obtain low-cost financing. Now, my lecture today focuses on the Dodd-Frank Act's impact on investor protection in securitization transactions. And I'll begin the analysis by examining securitization's role in the recent financial crisis. But I want you to keep a certain perspective in mind. Investors in securitization transactions are big institutions, banks, insurance companies, pension funds, hedge funds. Many of these institutions are so large, so sophisticated that they constitute qualified institutional buyers, or QIBs. And under SEC Rule 144A, they can basically trade securities as if these securities were essentially publicly registered. So throughout the lecture, just keep in mind that one might question whether Dodd-Frank or any other legislation the government might promulgate should have the goal of protecting these types of highly sophisticated investors. Now, let me describe briefly securitization's role in the recent financial crisis. The securitization of subprime mortgage loans, and these are essentially mortgage loans made to risky borrowers. This securitization is widely viewed as a root cause of the financial crisis. Securitization transactions were sometimes backed, at least in part, by the subprime mortgage loans. And the expectation was that these loans would be repaid by the mortgagors refinancing once home prices had appreciated. And since the Great Depression, as a general proposition, home prices had been rising. So that was the sort of way out, so to speak. The model worked very well until about 2007, when home prices stopped appreciating. And one question that comes up is, why did banks make these loans that would only be repaid if there was home price appreciation? Why did investors invest in them? And one argument, or one potential answer, is that there's something called the originate-to-distribute model of securitization. If I'm a bank and I make mortgage loans, I'm not going to hold on to those loans. I'm going to sell them off to the SPV, which is going to issue securities. And so I, as the bank, the theory goes, did not take any of the risk associated with the mortgage loans. And that creates the potential for so-called moral hazard. Moral hazard essentially is, think of moral hazard this way. If you have a car, I know some people live in D.C., you don't really need a car. But if you have a car and you get insurance, you always have a deductible on your insurance. Why do you have a deductible? Because the insurance companies believe that if they paid the first dollar of loss, you would drive like a crazy person, you'd park your car in terrible places, and so forth. And so the deductible basically is a defense effectively against the moral hazard. It dissuades you from taking excessive risk. So many believe that this originate-to-distribute model of securitization, which enabled mortgage lenders to sell the loans as they're made, encouraged the making of the subprime loans. Now, I will discuss in a few minutes other possible explanations of why subprime loans were made and securitized. But whatever the reason was, the fall in home prices meant that subprime borrowers who were relying on the home appreciation could not refinance. And also, many of the subprime mortgage loans had adjustable rates, which increased after the initial teaser period. And so borrowers who could not afford the rate increases they expected to refinance, they might not be able to repay the loans. As a result, many of these subprime borrowers began to default at a level greater than anticipated. Now, for ordinary securitization transactions, the defaults had localized consequences, but they had more systemic consequences in the case of what I will refer to as ABS-CDO transactions, which is a type of securitization of securitized assets. And I'm sort of simplifying this here, but essentially think of this. I mentioned that the SPVs would issue securities to investors. Now, those securities are backed by the mortgage loans and other basic financial assets. But where you have the securitization of securitized assets, the ABS securities themselves were then used as financial assets bundled together into SPVs, and multiple classes or tranches of securities were then issued to investors. And this created a high degree of leverage. And so as a result, small levels of default that were relatively small, but nonetheless levels above what were projected to default, caused some of the lowest priority of the classes of securities to default. And they also caused some of the higher classes of securities to be downgraded by the rating agencies, Standard & Poor's and Moody's and so forth. So one might ask, why did these transactions, these securitization transactions, degenerate to the point that even relatively small errors in cash flow projections caused defaults and downgradings? And one explanation is that securitizations focus on mathematical modeling to statistically predict the payments on the financial assets underlying these securities. This fostered an over-reliance on modeling and an abandonment of common sense. Another possible explanation is that investors seemed as anxious to buy these securities as the underwriters were anxious to sell them. But whatever the reason, these defaults and downgradings spooked the entire investor marketplace, investors in rated debt securities. The investors thought that a AAA security would not default and should not be downgraded. And if you even had a lower rating, like so-called investment grade, that there would not be the possibility of default. So investors began to lose confidence in the rating system, and they began to lose confidence in rated debt securities. Therefore, supply and demand, fewer investors, you know, and the price of debt securities began to fall. Falling prices meant that firms using debt securities as collateral had to mark them to market and put up cash, and there essentially was a collapse of the entire market price for debt securities. Give an example. In 2008, I was an expert in the High Court of Justice in England, and this was a bankruptcy of Orion Finance, the largest structured investment vehicle, or SIV. The market price at that time of the underlying mortgage assets was about 21 cents on the dollar, 21 cents. If you were to do an analysis of who the underlying obligors were, most of them were prime obligors. Most of the payments you could project, and you can come up with a number, logically, what that price should be, and it was close to the 80 to 90 cents on the dollar. So there was a great deal of panic. And then in 2008, September, the refusal of the government to save Lehman and the resulting bankruptcy added to this collapse. The debt markets virtually collapsed. No debt financing, or very little debt financing, meant that companies could no longer pay all their expenses, they couldn't grow, many failed. And these failures affected the real economy and certainly, at least in part, were contributing factors to the financial crisis. Now, the problems were also made worse by the fact that when you have the originate-to-distribute model of lending, the makers of the loans, essentially, they sell the loans off to the SPVs. The real owners of the loans are the investors in the SPV securities, and there are many, many such investors. So you have a problem. How should, when you have a default on a given mortgage loan, how should that default be treated? Should there be a foreclosure? Should there be a workout of sorts? And you had servicers who were hired to deal with this. And the servicers, in fact, had a standard In most cases, it was to act in the best interest of the investors. But that, in theory, was nice. In practice, it was more problematic. There were two problems, at least two problems. One problem was that the foreclosure cost was very minimal, very small. The workout costs were much more, you know, much higher in many cases, and certainly more variable. And furthermore, a foreclosure was somewhat ministerial. You did it, it happened. A workout could expose, was an exercise of judgment, and therefore you might be subject to liability if you were a servicer. So that's a scenario. Let's now consider how Dodd-Frank responded to this. Dodd-Frank addresses securitization by focusing essentially on three types of issues. Number one, the adequacy of disclosure. And this is just for securitization, the adequacy of disclosure. Number two, conflicts between securitizers and investors. And number three, rating agency information. And when I discuss Dodd-Frank, I'm going to use a term that Dodd-Frank really uses quite a bit. The term is securitizer. And the term is somewhat imprecise, but essentially for our purposes, it will mean the originator itself, the company whose financial assets are essentially securitized, or the an investment bank that will pool the financial assets and basically put them into an SPV, which issues securities. So let's focus now on these three things: adequacy of disclosure, conflicts, and rating agencies. First, adequacy of disclosure. Dodd-Frank directs the SEC to require more standardized disclosure of information regarding the underlying financial assets. It includes information on the assets underlying each class or tranche of the asset-backed securities, and this is intended to facilitate an easier comparison of different classes of the ABS. The Act also directs the SEC to require securitizers to engage in a due diligence review, okay, of the underlying financial assets and to disclose to the SPV's investors the nature of this due diligence review. So that's how Dodd-Frank treats it in a disclosure standpoint. The conflict standpoint, Dodd-Frank attempts to limit conflicts of interest between the securitizers on the one hand and the investors in the SPV securities on the other hand. And it does this by making sure that transactions, in securitization transactions, most of them, unless the financial assets are something called qualified residential mortgage loans, as to which parties are fighting what that really means. And Gretchen Morgenson had an interesting piece yesterday in the business section of the Sunday Times talking about the current political fights on that. But unless you have exclusively these qualified residential mortgage loans, the securitizers have to retain an unhedged economic interest in the credit risk of each class of the ABS that is issued. And colloquially, this is known as keeping, it's a horrible phrase, skin in the game. Okay, so if you're skin in the game, that's what it means. Now, the the minimum retained interest is generally 5%. It might be less in certain cases, but we could think of it as 5%. Thirdly, rating agency information. Dodd-Frank mandates the SEC to adopt regulations requiring rating agencies to explain in any report accompanying an ABS credit rating to basically explain the representations, the warranties, and the other enforcement rights available to the investors, including a comparison of how those rights differ from rights in similar transactions. Now, those are the sort of securitization-focused portions of Dodd-Frank. Dodd-Frank does other things in terms of trying to protect investors. It attempts to generally increase investor protection. It enables the SEC to impose a fiduciary standard in broker-dealers. In some cases, it provides special protections for older investors. But these protections probably have no application to securitization, where most, if not all, the investors are major financial institutions, not individuals, and hopefully not older people who are individuals either. So essentially, you have this limited application of Dodd-Frank. Dodd-Frank also says that a lot of the specific administrative rulemaking, or I should rephrase that, a lot of the application of the Act will be accomplished through the specific administrative agencies like the SEC. And the Act also creates something called the Financial Stability Oversight Council that can examine and monitor potential sources of systemic risk and identify regulatory gaps. So the question now is, does Dodd-Frank address securitization's flaws? And I believe that it inadequately does so. It addresses one of the flaws, or at least alleged flaws, as I mentioned. It underregulates other flaws, and it basically overregulates, I think, other areas that are not flawed. And let me explain why. First, that Dodd-Frank addresses one of securitization's flaws. This is the originate-to-distribute model. And Dodd-Frank, as I mentioned, requires securitizers to retain skin in the game, some realistic risk of loss. The theory is that by aligning the incentives of the securitizers with the interests of the ultimate investors in the SPV securities, the lending industry will become more disciplined. Now, this assumes that the originate-to-distribute model was a cause of the problem, and it might have been. I'm not saying it wasn't, but I will point out that there are also other theories as to why securitization got into trouble. For example, there was a great deal of U.S. government pressure on lenders and on Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac and so forth to originate and securitize subprime loans. And this was in order to enable even poor people to afford housing. Okay, so you had that mixing of politics and finance. Secondly, there was this huge liquidity glut at the time. And banks were making loans at low interest rates on things called covenant light. Okay, they were basically not going through the typical financial rigor that they ordinarily should. Rates were just artificially low, people could say. And who knows the extent to which the subprime mortgages were simply part of that whole consideration. You also had potential conflicts of interest between the lending firms and their employees. Employees of lenders basically would make money by basically originating the loans, and those loans might have been originated in some cases, even though they wouldn't have made sense from the institution's standpoint. Also, the originate-to-distribute model does not really fully explain why standards were lowered for originating mortgage loans, but not other types of financial assets. And so that's a question. And finally, it doesn't explain why the ultimate investors in these securities of the SPV, you know, these big financial institutions, the QIBs, why they didn't have this apply the same strict lending standards and discipline to the types of financial assets and securities that they were investing in. Now, we're never going to know for sure the extent to which the originate-to-distribute model actually contributed to the financial crisis. It's also ironic, just one thought, more thought about originate-to-distribute. It's somewhat ironic that skin in the game, this essentially removing this conflict between the originator and the ultimate investors, this could have a certain backfiring effect. I've argued a few years ago that one of the reasons a lot of these sophisticated investors invested in these securities without really engaging in the proper due diligence, is that the underwriters of these securities, also big institutions, in fact had skin in the game, and more than the type of skin mandated by Dodd-Frank. In many cases, they retained the most subordinate interests, the so-called equity interests, the unrated pieces of these ABS CDO issuances. And the fact that they took essentially the primary loss position on these securities in many cases induced other investors to buy into the senior portions. And so there could be this, what I referred to as a mutual misinformation problem, as opposed to, it's not just asymmetric information, but one party misleading, but one party not fully understanding it, creating misinformation on the other side. Now, to its credit, Dodd-Frank does mandate the Financial Services Oversight Council to study and submit a report to Congress on the macroeconomic effects of the skin in the game requirement. And this would include possibly proactively regulating mortgage origination as an alternative or a supplement. We want to be a little careful there. One of the things that could be done, for example, is to apply to mortgage lending the same types of requirements that one saw after the Great Depression applied to margin lending. And I've argued in the past that there are great parallels between the Great Depression and what recently happened. The Great Depression relating to the types of mortgage loans that were, margin loans that were done. These were loans to enable borrowers to acquire publicly traded stock, securing the loans by the stock, and in recent cases, the recent crisis, loans to enable borrowers to essentially acquire homes, securing the loans by the home. But we want to look at that. There could be stuff that comes out in the future on this. They could impose, for example, the same type of collateral requirements. In the margin case, there's a minimum of 2-to-1 collateral coverage for these margin loans that are secured by the margin stock. You could require something like that in terms of the value of the house compared to what you put up as collateral. And that could be good in terms of preventing default, but it would be terrible in terms of encouraging home ownership because very few people could afford essentially 50% equity in their houses. Now, the second part is that Dodd-Frank, I think, under-regulates and fails, in fact, completely to regulate some flaws. It does not in any meaningful way, for example, address the danger of mixing politics and finance as occurred before the recent financial crisis with the pressures I mentioned by the government on lenders to originate and securitize subprime mortgage loans. Also, Dodd-Frank does not address the problem of over-reliance on mathematical modeling. Now, mathematical models are not problematic per se. The model is realistic and the inputted data are reliable. Models can yield very accurate predictions of real events. But if the model is unrealistic or if the inputted data are unreliable, and this occurred before the recent financial crisis, then the models can be very misleading. To some extent, I think that over-reliance on mathematical models should be self-correcting. Financial crisis has shaken faith in the markets, shaken confidence in the market's reliance on mathematical models, and I think in the short term, there'll be much less of that type of artificial reliance. However, experience has shown that in the long term, as Business Week once put it, investors go for the gold. They tend to have short memories, and if the yield, the rate of return on investments is high, they may forget all the critical lessons. Now, Dodd-Frank also fails to address what I refer to as the complacency problem. And this is a problem of human behavior. This is the problem that people do not fully appreciate what they were buying. They relied on others, the fact that others were investing. There was a certain degree of herding behavior where many investors would invest in a certain type of asset. Other investors would want to do the same. There is safety in numbers. And this is a problem that I think will be with us always. I thought back to when I was a law student. I took a seminar on legislation with this wonderful professor, Frank Grad, who was this great legislative scholar. And at the end of every class, he would say, you know, the problem is not that much statutory drafting. The problem is the fact that the statutes apply to people, and that's an issue. So, good lesson. Finally, Dodd-Frank does not address the servicing problem, the so-called conflicts, the ministerial foreclosure, and so forth. I find that less troublesome, though. Parties can, and they should have incentive to write the underlying deal documents to set clearer, more flexible guidelines, more certain reimbursement procedures for loan restructuring when it's superior to foreclosure. Parties also can try to prevent the sort of conflicts in cash flows. Prior to the crisis, or during the crisis, you had these ABS CDO security issuances. Some of the classes were interest-only securities. Some were principal-only securities. So how do you do a workout? If you reduce the principal but not the interest, then the people who have reduced principal get upset, and vice versa. So you try to structure the deals, the underlying securities, to mitigate these problems. And there are also other ways you can deal with it. I've argued that one thing that should be at least be considered is that servicers, when they act in the best interest of the investors, they should be protected perhaps by something akin to a business judgment type rule, so they at least can exercise discretion, you know, and judgment in terms of what they do. Now, finally, I think that Dodd-Frank overregulates by addressing aspects of securitization that are not flawed. And to give, I gave the example of the skin in the game. Dodd-Frank also might overregulate in its requirements for more standardized disclosure of information. In principle, it should be helpful for investors to get this standardized information, including about the financial assets underlying each class of ABS. But my experience, frankly, is that prospectuses already provide this. And Dodd-Frank also requires securitizers to engage in a due diligence review of underlying financial assets and disclose to investors the nature of the review. In my experience, too, that's routinely done. So the larger problem is not the disclosure. Disclosure, you know, there's very few challenges to disclosure in the recent crisis. The real problem is that investors don't read the disclosure. And when they do, they don't always understand it. And there are two reasons for that. Now, one reason is complacency, as I've discussed. Another reason is there's actually a conflict of interest within the investing firms themselves. And as investments become more complex, conflicts are increasingly driven by short-term management compensation schemes, especially for technically sophisticated secondary managers. I'll give an example. The value at risk, or VAR, model. This was a model for measuring investment portfolio risk, and it became widely accepted. Financial firms began to compensate their secondary managers not only for generating profits, but also for generating profits with presumably low risk as measured by VAR. So the managers, they're not dumb. They turned to investment products that had a high rate of return but a low VAR risk profile, like credit default swaps, okay? Now, the managers in some cases may well have known but didn't always explain to their seniors that, yes, there was a small chance of loss, but if the loss occurred, it could have been a woozy. It could have been very huge. This is an intra-firm conflict. It's very much unlike the traditional focus of scholars and politicians on conflicts between senior managers and shareholders. This is a conflict between senior managers and secondary managers. Dodd-Frank attempts to fix the conflict, but the traditional conflict between the shareholders and the directors. Dodd-Frank does nothing about this secondary manager conflict between the senior managers and the secondary managers. Dodd-Frank also, I mentioned, has this focus on disclosure. And I've written elsewhere that disclosure can never, in these days, be a complete answer to complexity. Things have become so complex that you can disclose it all you want. People are not going to understand the disclosure. A typical prospectus for an ABS CDO transaction is about 400 pages. And I must tell you that even an expert reading that will not fully understand it, much less an analyst who may be looking at a whole multitude of transactions. Now, the rating agencies also mandate the SEC to adopt regulations requiring rating agencies to report on securitization transactions, for example, explaining the rights available to investors, comparing those rights with similar rights in similar transactions. This is a bit incongruous. It puts a disclosure obligation on rating agencies. These are private parties, and their job is to assess the likelihood of a default. To the extent this information is material, and I think it is, it should already be required to be included in the prospectuses, the information statements accompanying the sale of ABS. And so requiring rating agencies to also disclose this information really is somewhat duplicate. Now, the only saving grace to that, I think, is that in many cases, rating agencies may have broader industry knowledge than some of the underwriters, but that's going to be a question. So let me set out my conclusions. At the outset of the lecture, I question whether Dodd-Frank or any other legislation should have the goal of protecting the largest and most sophisticated investors. I do not believe these investors need protection as a matter of government paternalism. But their failures, the failures of these investors, can cause terrible externalities, terrible harm, because the failures we've seen could have systemic consequences, could bring down portions, if not all, of the financial system. And so to the extent we should be protecting these investors, we should not be doing it, I think, for their own good per se. We should be doing it to protect the financial system and thereby indirectly protecting all the investors. Secondly, I've observed that financial products such as securitization have become so complex that disclosure can never be a complete answer. And because of this increasing complexity, financial failures are and will continue to be inevitable. We cannot create any system to eliminate failure. And for this reason, I think more emphasis should be given, not necessarily on ex ante before the fact protections, but on ex post types of protections, such as financial market stabilizers, so that what occurred in the financial crisis, as you had subprime defaults start to trigger defaults on, you know, the lowest rated securities and downgradings of the highest rated securities, and that created a complete panic. Rather than that occurring, it would be great if the market were stabilized in some way. And finally, Dodd-Frank itself imperfectly addresses securitization, but the delegation of rulemaking to the administrative agencies and the power of the Financial Stability Oversight Council created by Dodd-Frank to monitor and consider fixes, I think, will be good for the future and hopefully will reflect in the future regulation that is more adapted, more suited to securitization. So thank you.
Stephen, thank you so much for your insightful commentary on Dodd-Frank. You've given us clarity, fresh perspective on its consequences, both intended and unintended, as well as discussing what it doesn't cover. but perhaps should have. We hope that today's lecture helps us to remember and reflect on Diane Sanger's contributions to effective and fair regulation. This lecture is now permanently preserved in the virtual museum and archive at www.sechistorical.org for access at any time, along with last year's lecture, which was presented by Nell Minow. We hope also that today's program recognizes all those who currently work in the regulation of financial markets, and that Diane's life serves as an inspiration for those who are considering such a career. Thank you for being with us today. Thank you.